recorded live by jml.org.au.
Security and to Jewish people. You know, throughout our history, we've had a difficult history, right? And under various political constitutions, various political societies, our people have suffered tremendous persecution. We've been denied power. We've been denied opportunity to earn a livelihood. We've been persecuted. We've been denied religious freedom. And yet, in democracies all over the world, Jewish people enjoy all the opportunities and the benefits that the rest of the population enjoy in equal measure. We have freedom to practice our religion as long as we pay taxes. We have, and some good Jewish accountants could help you with that as well, we have freedom to run for political office. If you look at even here in Australia, where the Jewish population is a very small fraction of a percentage of the general population, and yet we are well represented by some very competent, superb politicians at state level, at federal level, and so on. This is true in the United States of America. It's true in countries all over the world. We are allowed to participate in the governance of the countries that we live in democracies. We're allowed to educate our children in the ways that we wish to educate our children. We have these freedoms, we enjoy these freedoms, and we accept a father is a dictatorship. Kids, you have to go to your All right, Becky. Thank you very much. All right, so where were we before there was the revolution? So democracy has been good to the Jewish people. Democracy has been something that I think we have to be grateful for. Something that I'm not entirely sure that the Torah would be against, as this whole crowd was. So I'm already disagreeing with you. But it's my democratic right to be able to do that. I have free speech. I can say whatever I want. You have a choice to invite me back again next year to the Yarche Kala or not. That's also your free choice. You can vote me in or out. That's fine. But we could do that because we live in a democracy. So I don't know that democracy has been so bad to us that we should have trashed it right off the bat so quickly. Having said that, I would say that although democracy... I stand corrected. There is a difference. Okay, we didn't trash democracy. We just said that it's probably not the ideal Jewish view of how a government should be structured. Having said that, I would say that I'm quite personally pro-democracy, and I'm very happy that I live in a democracy. And I'm also a religious Jew, and I don't think that there's such a great divide between those two parts of those two opinions that I maintain, or those two philosophies that I subscribe to. There's not such a big divide. The two can coexist. In the Mishnah, in the Gemara, there's a concept of Shiva Tuve Ha'ir. There are seven elders of every city, and these elders are by consensus of the community, by vote, are placed into their position, and they have authority. And that goes back 2,000 years, that Jewish people have been having a sort of a democracy within their communities. And there are many other sources that we could find, that's not what tonight's class is, where it would seem that there are certain constructs within Torah that actually support the notion of a democracy, similar to how it is actually practiced in most countries in the world today. So I wouldn't even agree with the consensus in the room, the democratic consensus in the room, that Torah is not so pro-democracy. But again, that's not really tonight's subject. What I do want to say about democracy is that there is one, that there are a couple of potential pitfalls for a religious Jew living in a democratic society. And these things are sometimes very subtle, and of course when things are subtle, that makes them even more important, not less important, because they're less obvious, and we notice them less. They could be insidious, they could creep in to our psyche and our way of thinking, and they could do a lot of damage. So, living in a democratic society, we believe, and I would say thank God, that every person has an equal say in how a government, in who should be the government and how the government should run. We all have an equal vote in a democracy, by definition. Any democracy that you look at, there's different flavors, but more or less, or not more or less, but absolutely at the center of every democracy is the fact that every person has a vote, every person has an equal say. You can't say, if your father was from nobility, therefore you have more of a vote than somebody else. In a democracy, it doesn't work like that. In a democracy, we all have the same vote. Clever people have the same vote. Dumb people have the same vote. Beautiful people have the same vote. Ugly people have the same vote. It doesn't matter. That's what a democracy is by definition. Which is good. Fantastic. That means that even Jewish people, and throughout much of our history we've been disenfranchised, which means that we haven't had an equal vote and an equal say than everybody else, but in a democracy Jewish people have an equal say to everybody else. My vote counts as much as anyone else's vote, whether you're 50th generation Australian or whether you're a new immigrant, your vote counts the same. However, it's very easy to make a fatal mistake in a democracy. This is the mistake. Listen carefully. Because we believe in the right for every person to have the same vote, which is the underpinning of all democratic society, we could very easily slip and make the following mistake and say that just as everybody has a right to vote, everybody's opinion has equal value. Ooh, now we've gone into dangerous territory. Having the right to vote politically, in a political context, having equality, very good. Tick. It's got the good housekeeping seal of approval. No problem there. But when we extend that, when we extend that notion and we start thinking, okay, if everybody has an equal vote, then everybody's opinion is of equal value. Oh, now we've gone into dangerous territory. Why do I say dangerous territory? Because now we enter the realm of the absurd, where we start thinking that everybody, it's called moral relativism, that everybody's opinion, everybody's values are equal. That is not true. That's why you have people who wake up in the morning. Actually, they don't even wake up in the morning. For months they plan. For years they plan to harm, kill, maim, injure as many innocent men, women, and children as possible. And instead of turning to these monsters who premeditate murder and malice, and call them terrorists, we call them freedom fighters. We say, perhaps they have an opinion that has merit. Don't just dismiss them because they put poison-laden nuts and bolts and pieces of metal shard in them and blew themselves up to smithereens in the hope of harming as many people as possible. Don't look at them negatively. Maybe they have an opinion. Let's listen to them. Let's see why they're doing that. Let's try and understand it. Where does that come from? Where does that bizarre thinking come from? How come we don't unequivocally turn towards people who are terrorists and call them terrorists? And the answer comes because we live in a democratic society and we make the mistake that because everybody's vote is equal, therefore everybody's values are equal. And as Jewish people, we know that is not true. We have divine values that were given to us from Hashem in His Torah, and those are the values that we hold sacred and precious. And somebody who comes along as an experiment, as they do in our society, and they say, perhaps those values have become antiquated. They're old-fashioned. I have a new set of values. We stop and we listen to them. Now, why do we listen to them? Why don't we have an innate revulsion? Why don't we instinctively react and say, no, that is a terrible way of, that's a terrible value system. That's terrible morality. That's so destructive and unhealthy. Why don't we do that? Because we live in a democracy. And in a democracy, you have to give everybody equal vote. And therefore, we think everybody has, everybody's moral position has equal value. And that is not true. So that's one pitfall that you have to be careful of if you're living in a democracy, that you don't allow that to happen. A second pitfall that a person could experience by living in a democracy is the fact that a democracy, the underpinnings of any democratic society, are that human beings have inalienable rights. Each and every one of us has a right. We have a right to pursue happiness, liberty. We have a right to pursue to free speech. We have a right to be protected by our government. We have a right to be protected by the police force, etc., etc. It's a whole bunch of rights. And again, I say Baruch Hashem. Baruch Hashem, we live in a society where a Jew has equal rights to all these protections than anybody else has. It's a good thing. But there's a pitfall. There's a danger. What's the danger? The danger is that rights, a society based on rights, that focuses on rights, is a society that focuses on what's in it for me. What do I gain from it? What are my rights? What do I get for being a citizen? What do I get for this? And that is very unhealthy. Human beings are not consumers, we're contributors. We are only truly happy, we are only truly have a sense of fulfillment when we are giving, when we are contributing to our fellow man. And the problem with living in a democracy is we could start viewing ourselves as consumers. Animals consume. Human beings produce. Yes, in order for human beings to produce, we need to do a little bit of consumption. But the consumption is just there to support the production. By animals, it's purely about taking. And in a democracy, when we live in a democracy, we could shift into that way of thinking, that mindset, that we are purely taking. A third problem with living in a democratic society for a religious Jew is that a democracy basically says that there's no hierarchy, there's no leadership that's top-down. We create our leaders. We vote a leader, and then after a few years, if we're not satisfied with the job that we're doing, we vote them out of power, we vote somebody into power. That's wonderful in a democracy. Baruch Hashem. Thank God we live in democracies where we have the power and ability to do that. But that's not so good in a religious context. Because in Judaism, we need to know that there's a hierarchy of leadership. There's God at the top, for starters. God is at the top of that pyramid. And what he says goes. And that's not a very popular thing in democracies. People in who were raised in a democratic environment don't like to subjugate themselves to a higher authority. Because they don't have that in government. In government, there's no such thing as absolute subjugation to a higher authority. If you're not pleased with the authority, you have the power to upset that authority and to get rid of that authority. In Judaism, it's very important that we listen to our rabbis, that we listen to the Chachamim, in the Gemara, in the Shulchan Aruch. And we may want to conduct our lives in a certain way, but we have to train ourselves to follow their directives, to follow how they have explained to us what Hashem's will is. And that is at odds with democratic thinking. So while I still maintain that democracies are good, it's a very good development, it's good for the Jews, which of course is our litmus test for anything, isn't it? While I maintain that democracy is good for the Jews, nonetheless, I also caution that there are certain attitudes that democracy breeds, and we have to be very careful about these, about absorbing, assimilating and integrating these attitudes into our psyche and our way of thinking, because they are negative in terms of our spiritual growth. So far, have I lost any votes?
Historically, for the most part, democracy has been good for the Jews. The National Socialist Party, the Democratic Party, The question was, there have been democratically elected governments, like for example the Nazi Party, who came into power through democracy, and it hasn't turned out very well for the Jews. I agree. However, it's not because they were democratically elected that it didn't turn out for the Jews. Things went bad when they threw democracy out of the window. In other words, it was only when in Germany and in other places in the world where Jews have been persecuted, it's only after the governments have become autocratic and dictatorial, that's when things started going bad for the Jews. But in countries that are constitutionally democratic and democracy is entrenched in the society, for example, the United States of America being the greatest example on earth of this, Jews have flourished. And so that was my point. So under democracy, they flourish. In fact, the question, I think, actually, if anything, bolsters and proves my point. It was the moment that Germany stopped being a democracy that Jews got into trouble. Assimilation is also a result of democracy. If everybody is equal, so the clear demarcation that should exist between faith communities starts becoming eroded, because in general, everyone has an equal vote. So yes, it is. All right. However, it's a nuanced endorsement, but it's still an endorsement of democracy. Now we'll get back to the question which sparked our discussion, and that is, how would God vote? But before I could answer that question, I want to ask something which has always intrigued me. Now, I just want to say that I have voted on three continents. I'm a citizen of two countries, and please God, in the next 2 or 3 weeks, I will become a citizen of another country, and I will be obliged to vote as well in that country. It's the first country that I've actually been obliged to vote, but I've always taken my democratic duties quite seriously. I know Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he discusses the responsibility that people have to participate in democratic elections and to vote. In Australia, of course, you guys, and soon me, us, don't have a choice. We must vote. It is obligatory. And so I'll vote on four different continents. And I've noticed, because I took my democratic duties and take them seriously, I've been fascinated by why certain issues coalesce around certain parties. So, just to make this easy and simplistic, let's call them left and right. Now, speaking of left and right, reminds me of an old Hasidic story. And I apologize up front for telling the story. I probably shouldn't tell it, but since we're being politically incorrect tonight, I'm going to tell the story anyway. This story took place in Russia a couple of hundred years ago, which was a very interesting place politically. There were a lot of new political ideas that were entering into the general discussion, into the zeitgeist. People were talking about new ideas, democracy, capitalism versus the czar, versus socialism, etc., communism. There were all sorts of different ideologies that were floating about, and everybody was talking, and specifically they were talking about the left and the right, and what's better? Is it better to vote left? Is it better for the Jews? Is it better to vote right? Now, today, if you want an opinion, where do you go? Where do you go if you want to fix the world, let's say? Let's say you think the world is broken, and you want to find a person who could fix the whole world. Where do you find such a person? The answer is, any cab driver will be able to fix the whole world. You go to any cab driver, especially in Israel or America, you go to the cabbies over there, and you ask them, I'll tell you what the problem is with, Obama. I'll tell you what needs to be fixed. I'll tell you. The cabbies know everything. So here there was a person, and there were a group of people, they were Hasidim, and they were traveling to Lubavitch, to the Rebbe in Lubavitch. They were traveling on their wagon. The Rebbe Rashab, I believe it was the Rebbe Rashab, maybe the Rebbe Marash, said that there would never be a train passing through the city of Lubavitch. A train would never pass through Lubavitch. Was the Tzemach Tzedek already? Alright, the Tzemach Tzedek said that there'll never be a train passing through Lubavitch. Now, there was like, modern technology will never touch that place. And till today, the train stops before Lubavitch. You have to get onto a wagon, probably even today a wagon, I don't know, maybe a car, maybe, but probably a wagon, to get the final distance from the train station to the village of Lubavitch. So, it was a good business if you had a wagon and a good sturdy horse. You, every day you could go and pick up the Hasidim and transport them down to Lubavitch. Was great. And of course I can imagine that Hasidim would gather from all over to come to Lubavitch. It was interesting conversations, and since everybody was talking left and right and left and right, so they were all talking which is better for the Jews, and one of them turns to the wagon driver, who was probably a Hasidish Yid. They turn to the wagon driver and they say, you know, Reb Zalman, what do you think? What do you think? Which is better, the left or the right? So this cabbie, or wagon driver, he says, listen, what do I know from political parties, left or right? I know from horses. And you'll excuse me, but when a horse is walking, horses don't defecate in the bathroom, sorry to say, but they just do it wherever they're walking. So when my horses, I have these two horses, when they're walking and they need to, you know, spell waste, so they do it over there. And he says, the wheel of my wagon splits the waste into two parts, a left and a right. He said, but it's the same substance. I don't want to say it in the original Yiddish. He said a little bit more colorful than that. You could use your imagination. So, left or right, which one is better? So, according to that cab driver, it's the same thing. But it has always fascinated me. I think somebody said, the difference between capitalism and socialism. You know what the difference between capitalism? Capitalism is the exploitation of man by man, and socialism is the exact opposite. But we need a better definition than that. What's left mean? What's right mean? Why do certain policies, certain issues, consistently, whether it's the United States of America, whether it's Canada, whether it's South Africa, whether it's Australia, whether it's Israel, why do certain governments, left-wing governments, have common policies, and why do right-wing governments have common policies? So, if you go to the United States of America, Republicans, which are right-wing, they will believe in gun ownership. So Republicans, by and large, they believe they are NRA, card-carrying members of the NRA, which is the National Rifle Association of America, one of the most powerful lobbying bodies, if not the most powerful lobbying body in the United States of America. And they'll be anti-abortion, so, or they'll be pro-school prayer. So what do guns, anti-abortion, and school prayer have in common? School prayer and guns. See any commonality between those? So how come almost all right-wing governments, no matter where you are in the world, will have similar ideas on those issues, and all left-wing governments will have similar opinions on their issues? Perhaps I wondered, perhaps they flip a coin and they go, we'll take school vouchers, welfare. There's got to be some kind of coalescing idea that brings together a range of issues from right-wing governments and left-wing governments. Is there anybody who could suggest some idea that brings it all together? Yes. The suggestion was that perhaps the difference is more centralization and less centralization. And I like that definition, because that was my starting point, what I started. more family oriented verses. What were the other, the opposite? Left more individualistic, right more family oriented. We'll come back to that one. What?
When
yep. 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 No, no, I like the family part of it. I just wasn't sure about the other side of things. Okay. We'll come. You're on to something for sure. Let's try and refine it together and see if we can come up with something helpful and useful. All right. So let me tell you my opinion of what the difference is, based on something I once read that Shamshon Raphael Hirsch wrote. He wrote a very interesting thing. We all are in very, as we know, those who are following the parshas of this week, it's very exciting. I mean, we started off with Bereishis with a bang, literally like a big bang. God created the whole world. And then, after that, we saw the Avos, and then the incredible story. I mean, in all of literature, there's probably no more dramatic story than Yosef, the brother who gets sold into slavery, and then rises up. What a story. Rabbis love these parshas. We can make so many drushes out of these parshas, it feels like we're cheating. And now we go into Shmois. Beautiful. Shmois, the Exodus, the Yetzias Mitzrayim, beautiful, excellent. Yeah. And then we hit a road bump. Vayikra. What's Vayikra? Tuma, Tara, Karbadis, has no relationship to us. But Shamshon Raphael Hirsch said something that made it come a little bit alive for me personally. He said, speaking about Tuma and Tara is very, very difficult, very precise, very mathematical, and since it doesn't seem to be very relevant, it's quite tedious to get through all the laws of Tum and Taru. We learn in the Rambam and we hit those laws as well. Whew, you start, you know, your eyes fog over. It's hard to see because, first of all, the notion of Tum and Taru in itself is a very difficult notion to grasp because it's not physical. You know, the other parts of Torah are very physical. If my ox gores your cow, how much money do I owe you? And all that kind of stuff is definable. It's easy. We can relate to it, you know. My car bashes into your car. We can relate to these things. But Tuma and Tara, you can't relate to it. What is Tuma? It's like this mysterious force. And what is Tara? It's also a mysterious force. It's very hard to define. There's nothing physical that is analogous to Tuma and Tara. Says Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, if you look at Tumah, you'll see that there's a common element to anything that becomes Tumah. What is the worst Tumah? The Avi Avos HaTumah. What is the father of all, for the grandfather of Tumah? What's the worst Tumah? A dead body. A cadaver is the father of all Tumah. So we associate, so Tumah is somehow associated with death. There's Tsaras, this spiritual disease which doesn't exist today, a skin disease that afflicts a person, or a house for that matter. That's also a kind of a tumor. There's a zav. A zav is a person who has a certain disease and they can't control their body. Their body expels certain fluids. They become a zav, or a zav, the female version of that. And that also creates a kind of a tumor. If you look at all these things, says Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, you'll see that all things that are susceptible to tumor have a common denominator. What is that common denominator? Man loses control. In all of these things, people lose control. If you're dead, if a person is dead, means they've lost, that's the ultimate loss of control. Now they're no longer in control of anything. When a person is alive, that's when they can be in control. If a person is suffering from being a zav or a zava, or any of these tumors, you'll see that they all are about losing control to some degree or another. Tara, the way that you become Tohar, primarily, is you dip in water, you go to a mikveh. And a water represents life, represents things that grow, that are alive. And when things are alive, they're in control. They can determine to a degree their own destiny. And so Tumah, say assumption of Fell Hirsch is partly there to wean us off the notion that we are not in control of our destiny, that we are just a random accident. And it's interesting that Shamshon Rafael Hirsch wrote this at the same time that a certain school dropout called Charles Darwin was writing a different book. And that book posited the theory that we are totally accidents. We have no control over our destiny. We are random accidents. That's how we came to be what we are. So these two competing worldviews, the worldview of Tumma think is you can't control anything. Mother Nature is in total control of you. And Tara think is that you are in control, that you can forge your own destiny. And it suddenly struck me when I read that, that perhaps that's the difference between the left and right divide. I believe that right-wing governments essentially believe in the faults of human beings. Believes that we're fallible, that we're selfish, that we're greedy. So it has a realistic view of human psychology. You know, right-wing governments, they're called conservative. What does conservative mean? What word does it come from? Conserve. What does conserve mean?
Preserve.
To preserve. What are you preserving? So, what are you preserving?
Life.
Values. What's that? Okay, hold on 1 second. I'll tell you what they're conserving. They're not conserving values. Because if they were conserving values, let's say you were an Aztec. So in the Aztec society, if you wanted to, if the rains didn't come this year, there was a very easy solution. What happens if the rains don't come? You take a maiden, an unmarried woman, and you sacrifice her to the gods. The rains will come. Now, if you're a conservative Aztec, so you want to conserve child sacrifice. Reagan was conservative. If he was truly a conservative by your definition, that he wanted to conserve the values of old generations, he should have believed in slavery and not allowed women to vote. So obviously, thankfully for all conservatives everywhere, conserving doesn't mean to conserve for conserving's sake. It's not just to conserve values. Conservatives are conserving one thing, specifically. They are conserving a person's right to make moral choices for him or herself, and for those moral choices to live then with the consequences of those moral choices, whatever they are. That's what they're conserving. That is the single thing that they're conserving. They are conserving our right to make stupid mistakes, or clever ones, or clever decisions, but it's our right. And then it's our right to suffer the consequences of those decisions. So that's why you will very rarely find a right-wing government who says that you can't smoke. All anti-smoking legislation is introduced by left-wing governments. Because left-wing governments have a very different view. Their starting point starts normally in an academic ivory tower with some great professor who writes a book and gets lots of adherents, mostly young university students, to buy into his quixotic vision, to buy into his utopian vision. And that vision is of a perfect world, and it really does sound beautiful. Brotherhood, peace, togetherness, kumbaya, we're all going to be happy, right? Then they go and they kill 80 million people to try and implement that theory. Why? Because they don't trust you to make your own decisions. Only the government can bring the world towards this utopia. So the more power you have, the further away we're going to be from this utopia. So we're going to tax you to take your money. And then we're going to spend it how it should be spent. We're going to create laws that are going to curtail how businesses could conduct their business. Because they're left to their own devices, they're going to conduct their business in ways that are unfair and unjust. We're going to now come back to the family point, because it was a good point you made. Conservative governments all over the world, right-wing governments, are very pro-family. You know why? Because family is the smallest viable unit of governorship that there can be. besides individuals. In other words, left-wing governments, they say that we centralize everything. That was the definition that was given here. I like that. We centralize everything. So we take away the responsibility to educate children, for example, from the families, and we give that to the schools. So the school, my wife's going to kill me for saying this, but I'm going to say this anyway. Don't tell my wife, please. We have a secret, right? Okay. My wife, in her university studies, has never got less than a high distinction for any subject. Every single subject she gets a high distinction, except the subject she's doing right now. The subject she's doing right now is, it has some very innocent name. I think it's called inclusion in the classroom. What it really is getting teachers to teach that things like gay relationships is a viable alternative to heterosexual relationships. It's about exposing very young children from the age of 5-6 years old to pornographic material. And that's what they want my wife to write in her paper. So she's struggling. I think she wrote a brilliant paper. Brilliant! Because she said, and she, it wasn't too controversial, she said that when you're teaching these concepts, when a child asks you a question in a classroom, you need to take the family's values into consideration when you're giving the response. You need to take the family values into consideration. So if you would go to a Beth Rivka and teach in a Beth Rivka, you would have a certain appropriate response for that milieu, for that environment, which takes into consideration the families and their values, that perhaps in another context, you may have given a different representation, taking into account the family values there. That was my wife's thesis. Doesn't sound too controversial. She got a 72. That's like a failure for her. It's a failure for her. Because why? That's not what they wanted to hear. It's a religion with these people. It's a religion. We could teach morality much better to our children than the government could teach our children to be moral citizens in a much more effective way than the nuclear family could, than the individual family could. We want to take away the burden of responsibility for them because they'll mess it up. What do conservatives say? We want to conserve people's ability to design and style their own families. So how would God vote? No, we're saying your family gets to decide how you're going to. Okay. All right. So the question has been raised about pro-life. So let's talk about pro-life for a second. In all women's issues. So pro-life. Let's talk about pro-life for a moment. Pro-life fits into a category of women's issues, let's say. And in women's issues, I've found pro-life means anti-abortion. Means that they consider abortion to be murder, and they will not allow a woman to have an abortion. A pro-life philosophy is against abortion. So, being pro-life is a woman's issue. Or let's say a child issue. And in children's issue, there also seems to be a very clear demarcation to me between left-wing and right-wing philosophies. Left-wing, listen, first of all, let me just say, many people who are left-wing, love their children very much, right? They adore their children. Many people who are left-wing consider their children to be the manifestation of their greatest hopes and dreams. Many people on the right also think the same way. But there is a fundamental difference, like with all these things. The difference is as follows. Left-wing people see their children as a continuation of themselves. They love their children. They adore their children. They give their children every opportunity that they can. There's some good left-wing parents, some terrible left-wing parents. There's some good right-wing parents. There's some terrible right-wing parents. That's across the board. The difference is that a right-wing parent will see their children as the continuation of their moral philosophy. Okay, so why do we have children? Why do we Jewish people have children? We have children because it is the continuation of what Hashem wants in this world. Hashem wants Jewish people to do mitzvahs in this world, and there's only one way you can have Jewish people doing mitzvahs in this world. You've got to have children. They haven't yet invented a different way of doing that. So therefore, what do we see our children as? Yes, we want them to succeed. We want them to be healthy. We want all these great things. They are the fulfillment of our greatest aspirations, dreams, and hopes. But what do we want from our... Why do we really want children? Really, really, what should be the motivation to have children? The motivation to have children is we're bringing more neshamas into this world. We bring more neshamas into this world means there's going to be more Torah mitzvahs. That means that there's going to... purpose for which Hashem created the world, the Sakan Oyin B'malchus Shindal Yud, that is going to take place because there are going to be more people that we are going to raise with our philosophies, with our morality, with our ethics, with our beliefs, and they are going to propagate that and raise their children with their beliefs, and there will be Jewish continuity, there will be continuation. That's why we have children. Left-wing people have children for a whole different set. They don't see children essentially as being the conduit for how their morality can pass on from generation to generation. That affects almost every aspect of how left-wing and right-wing people view children. So therefore, pro-life is all about suffering the consequences of the decisions that you make. If a woman has a child, becomes pregnant, and she doesn't want that pregnancy, a right-wing philosophy will be, excuse me, you made your bed, you've got to lie in it. You decided to have children, you decided to do an act which resulted in a child that's unwanted, you now have to live with the consequences of that decision. That's a right-wing philosophy, because we conserve your right to make moral decisions and then to fail and to live with the consequences of those moral decisions. That's what conservatives are about. Liberals, or left-wing people, liberals with a small L, liberals, left-wing people, they look at a person, they say, no, why should you curtail your own pleasure, your own lifestyle, because of something as inconvenient as a child? So don't worry. You made a mistake. You became pregnant. You shouldn't have been. Don't worry. We have a solution. Here it is. That would be a left-wing philosophy, because they are conserving the utopian view even at the cost of the individual. That's why when they tried to implement communism in the world, 80 million people lost their lives as a result of that. Because it doesn't matter the individual. They don't care about the individual. They care about the utopian worldview coming to fruition. All right. I've run out of time, as we we generally do when we're having such interesting conversations on such interesting topics. So I'll just conclude by saying, by referring back to Reb Moshe's tshuva about voting. Reb Moshe says that we have a responsibility to vote. If we don't vote, if we don't participate politically, we can't influence the political discourse. We can't influence how things work. And we have to think about these things. These are not things that we should follow the democracy. We shouldn't just go with the public opinion. I think we should be independent thinkers. We should think for ourselves. We should be contrarian. We should try and understand what the underlying philosophies and values are that are behind each single cohesive, coherent political philosophy. And I think as Jewish people and as from Jewish people, I think we have a responsibility to understand this. To understand this in a very deep way and to understand what is more in line with the kind of society that Hashem wants to create. Whether it's a Tumah-think society or whether it's a Tara-think society. Whether it's a society that conserves the individual's right to live a life as they want, or one that tries to remove that responsibility from our shoulders and place them on the shoulders of the collective. I think if we don't do this, if we don't have an understanding of how these things work and the consequences of these actions, then I think that sometimes we leave, then we relegate this discussion, this thought, to people who don't share our values, who don't share our end game, our vision for how the world should work, and therefore they create societies that are not the kind of societies that we would like to live in. I'll tell you, this is quite open and common knowledge, although I heard this first from a very big Rav and a Poisek, probably about 18 or 19 years ago, where this Rav said that there may come a time where it will be halakhically forbidden for a Jewish person to live in Quebec, Canada, which is where I lived for 18 winters, by the way. So, and why did he say that? Because he saw that there were certain political movements afoot that were going to have very serious consequences for how Jewish people could run their lives. And he was totally right. He was totally right. Today in Quebec, you are not allowed to teach your child. You're not allowed to send a child to a school where there's a poster on the wall that says something about Rosh Hashanah and a shofar, or an apple dipped in honey. They are not allowed to put a poster up on the wall in a kinder in Quebec, Canada, that says, apple, have a sweet new year, apple dipped in honey. Not allowed to do it. If you do that, then you have to also put up posters about Christmas and about Buddhist festivals and so on. It's all or nothing. Once the kids get to later years, to older years, they are forced to learn mamish about Avodah Zarah. The school system forces them to learn, and there is no longer an option to homeschool children in Quebec anymore, and there's no longer an option to school system to place children in private schools who get no government funding and teach them Torah as we like to teach them our Torah Sakodesh. You're not allowed to do it anymore. So as a result, many, many people my age who have young children, the same age as my children, have been forced to leave Quebec, Canada. That is a democratic country. But it's a democratic country where Jews have become lethargic, where Jews have decided that this is not something that they should involve themselves in, and they've left it to the French-Canadian politicians to make these incredibly discriminatory laws, and laws that make it untenable for a religious Jew to raise their children in that society. So we have to be vigilant. Now, when I say we have to be vigilant, I mean the community leaders have to be vigilant. And if our community leaders are vigilant and we trust them and they are steeped in an understanding of Torah and an understanding of how the world works, and they advise us to support certain political views, then we should look at the parties that share those values with us, and that's where we should place our efforts.
Thank you for listening to another one of our great recordings. We hope you enjoyed listening to this lecture and found it enriching and inspiring. To download and listen to many of our other recordings, please sign up today for a free membership via our website, www.jml.org.au.